Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where personal finance and career advice is finally fun.
And if you're new to the show or been around for a while and haven't done it, be sure to join our email list where you'll receive access to work and money tips, interesting reads, and more. You'll also receive our free 15-minute money plan as a welcome gift. Visit paybal.co/email to sign on up. Again, that's paybal.co/email.
Yes.
I met Leslie Tain, Esquire, a word that I don't get to use often enough, at Yahoo Finance Studios during our panel interview covering your questions on credit card debt. I have no doubt that everyone in the listening audience has already saw the show or anyone that cares about us as a brand and supporting as friends and individuals. But for the rest of you, I'll drop it in the show notes. Leslie is an attorney, debt therapist, and author of Life in Debt, A Fresh Approach to Achieving Financial Wellness. She has nearly 20 years experience in the practice of consumer and business financial debt related services and is highly accomplished in negotiating settlements with experience, having gone up against large national banks, credit unions, collection agencies, multiple legal representatives, all having fallen in her wake. We're happy to have her on the show because in the college educational system, debt-based offenses are considered especially heinous. In every city, the dedicated podcast hosts who investigate these vicious scams are members of an elite squad known as the Student Loan Unit. These are their stories. We're happy to have her on the show so you can learn to embrace your debt and learn more about your financial rights as a consumer. Well, welcome to the show, Leslie.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today.
I want to open with actually talking a little bit about student loan debt. So I think now we're seeing either a bigger market or at least more people going after it. I think I fell victim to this in a different way, but okay, maybe victim's the wrong way, but I definitely fell for the jig. So what are your thoughts on refinancing student loans?
So I think you need to understand the type of student loans that you have in the first place. I do get a lot of questions in my practice about refinancing student loans. And the reality is that some student loans are worth refinancing and others are not. So you have to take a look at what you have first. You need to understand, do you have a private loan or do you have a federal loan? And if you are going to refinance and you're refinancing that loan into a private loan, is it going to benefit you by doing so? What are your goals? So I often ask clients to sit down and write out their ultimate goals. Some people are looking to lower their interest rate. Some people are looking to consolidate a number of loans into one so they only have one payment. Some people are looking to get a cosigner off. And some people are actually looking to move their loans into private loan status for the purposes of potential renegotiation of those loans in the future. So depending on what your thoughts are on the process and what it is that you're looking to achieve, it may or may not work for you. In some cases, it doesn't make sense because if you're really just looking to repay those loans, you'll have more benefits, so to speak, with the federal-backed loans than you would with a private loan. They offer you many more repayment options, deferment, forbearance, which are different ways to hold off paying on your loans over a period of time. So you want to make sure that you're not going to give up something of value by refinancing, and also making sure that the loan isn't going to cost you more money. So for example, if you owe $30,000 and you're going to refinance the loan, are you refinancing $30,000 or are you going to be charged a refinance fee by the new loan company? Very often people think that it's no cost to get a new loan, but the reality is that even if you're refinancing and it doesn't cost you anything up front, you might actually be refinancing some of the cost of the loan within the loan. So using my example, if you were going to take out a $30,000 loan to refinance a current loan, is the new loan actually $30,000 or is it $31,000 or $32,000 because of fees? It's something that you really want to understand, and it is something that takes time. It can be very overwhelming, but I recommend strongly that you take out a notepad, you write down the terms of your current loan, your payment, what's your estimated payoff date, and the reasons why you want to make the change, and then look into refinancing and write a whole bunch of reasons down why it makes sense, doesn't make sense, and what it's going to cost you.
So for that refinance fee, is that easily disclosed or where can someone find that information? Is that like, so when I see a balance transfer as the example that I'm going to use, usually it says 3 to 5%. Is that easy to find or do you have to do some digging?
No, it shouldn't be something that's difficult to find. And they, again, that depends on where you're refinancing. So it should be made very, very clear in a loan disclosure statement to you. So you should be able to get a document that shows you how much you're borrowing, what the interest rates are, what the interest rates are being calculated, what your payments are going to be, how you can get help if you have trouble paying that loan. There should be a disclosure document. If there's no disclosure document for whatever reason, then it's something to reconsider. If you cannot easily find the terms of your loan or any loan that you ever take and it's difficult for you to ascertain that information, it would be my recommendation strongly to stay away from borrowing from that particular lender.
I know sometimes they'll have like, okay, if you see a fee at this range or rate, that's too much. Is there just a cutoff that you would have where they're paying too much for that refinance fee?
I do see ranges that are absurd, in my opinion. I have seen ranges from 11% to 25% on student loans. Those are very large percentage rates, and that's what makes it so difficult to repay it. You can liken that in similarity to a credit card, because most credit card interest rates are in those 11% to 20% range. I mean, there's obviously the ones that are below 11% and some that are above 20%, but that's the average. So if you're looking at the same and you look at the payoff schedule on a credit card balance, and they do show that to you on your statement, it's going to be a similar time frame that if you make only the minimum payment on a student loan with those type of interest rates, you're looking at 30, probably 22 to 35 years to pay that off. And then there's an amortization schedule. That means that when you're making payments on a loan amount and there's interest being added onto it, if you aren't making payments high enough to cover the interest payments, the remainder of the interest that's tacked on gets added to your principal, and then your principal gets larger and the interest becomes higher because the interest is now based on a higher balance. So again, for ease of discussion, I have seen that there are interest rates that are, in my opinion, absurd. They're legal, but they are very high, and those are loans that I would seriously reconsider taking. Some people have told me, well, I have a payoff plan, so I need to take the loan now because I don't have lump sum money, but I plan to pay it off, and this is how much I've allocated and budgeted to pay it off. So I know I'm going to pay some interest, but I'm going to pay it off within a short period of time. But if you're a young student and you have no plans to pay that off and you are going to go to graduate school, by the time that you graduate and that you're able to pay back that loan, the balance of your loan will be so high as a result of the interest that you will be strapped in what I would call a mortgage-type situation for 30-plus years.
And is this something you think people can do on their own, or is this something that they say partner with or get an expert? I mean, this sounds potentially overwhelming for some individuals, but do you think this is something they can take on themselves?
I definitely believe people can take on it themselves. However, I say that with this in mind. I see people who are anywhere from 17, 18 years old to 90 years old with student type of loans, whether they're co-signers, the original debtor. And at different ages and at different stages of your life, you have a different level of comprehension. So I know with my own children who are 18 that when we talk about the loans, it's way over their head. They don't even care. All they're interested in is going to college. They don't care what button they press. They just want to get past the discussion. They just, you know, there's no way that they even have the interest or the ability to comprehend the terms of the loan. They just, there's something that they want. As you get older and you become more mature and more capable of understanding certain loans, sometimes life gets in the way. You're stressed out about work, family, or otherwise. And then I've had people tell me, well, I didn't know what I was doing because, you know, I was so overwhelmed at work. I just was helping my kid get a loan, and therefore I did what I did. So that's why I say that at different points in your life, you have different levels of comprehension. You can do this on your own, but you need a clear head to be able to do it. You need some focus. You should take notes on it. If you don't understand, there are phone numbers that you can call related to that loan to get questions answered. I would take it kind of similar to the way when I went to law school, they taught us contract law. The way they taught us contract law, my professor would have us read word by word, line by line, and every single comma, exclamation point, whatever was in there grammatically, we would read up to that point. And whenever we came in front of a word that we didn't understand, we would look it up. And it seems kind of trivial as, you know, when you're in law school, and it was tedious, but it really taught me a lot, and certainly my colleagues who were in my class with me, that when you read a contract, you must read it word for word. When you come across a word that you do not understand, you need to get a definition of that. If you don't understand the totality of the document, and it's overwhelming for you. There are experts like myself in lots of different cities that understand this, and for small fees, and I would tell you and encourage you that even if it's $300, $400, $500 for a consultation, that is a bargain compared to the $30,000, $40,000, $80,000, $100,000 that you're going to borrow. So it's worth having somebody help you if you really are having difficulty struggling with understanding the terms of the loan that you're about to take out. I can't say it enough that you want an education, you're willing to pay for the education, and you know there are options out there, but the options out there really can tie up your future financially in such difficult ways and such complicated ways that you, as a young person taking this money, will not even realize what will happen to you in the future and the restrictions that it will cause. So I would encourage you to take the time, talk to somebody, find some help in understanding the type of loan that you're taking and definitions and terminology so that you can make an informed decision about whether that loan is right for you.
So for people who are still in school, I assume that's going to be a little bit different than externally. So is the recommendation for students, is that the financial aid office, or where can they find that help and resources? Because like you said, they may not be thinking in that future impact.
So my experience with financial aid offices is this. It's as good as the person on the other line. So I have spoken to some universities where in their financial aid office, they have people who are exceptionally helpful, where they're willing to answer questions. And that, those are great resources. I've also spoken with and experienced financial aid offices where they say to you, I can't tell you anything. You'll have to go, here's a link on our website. There's a number of loans there. Go figure it out on your own. We can't give you any information. So those are two extremes, but as a student, there are resources out there. Yes, it's difficult sometimes to find them online because there's a lot of them, and most of them are refinance consolidation and loan companies that are able to get at the top of the search engine. But you can ask your financial aid office if they've worked with anybody on the outside. You can ask a loan company, and you can ask other students. Go into a chat, a group chat. I know there's tons of them for colleges on Facebook where the kids are involved in various groups. And you can ask questions out there and say, has anybody worked with anybody to get assistance on student loan-related matters? I have questions. Has anybody had any other experience? Students today are really resourceful. They have so much at their fingertips. And I know that, you know, you can find a great concert to go to. So I know you can find a way to figure out how to find somebody to help you with it. You may not be as motivated, and it may be mundane and annoying, and it's easier just to sign on the line and get it over with. And there's a maturity factor there, but you absolutely can find the help if you want to try to seek it out.
So what you said there about financial aid offices kind of reminds me of career services offices, because I've heard the same thing where it's
yes, me too.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing where it's all about the person on the other side. So I'm glad you drove that point out.
Yeah, and how willing they are to help you. I, in both scenarios, even career services, which I've experienced as well when I was, you know, graduating from college and law school, the person on the other line is either willing to really help you and work with you, or they're not. And some, more often than not today, not everybody wants to be as helpful. You know, they want to get off the phone. So if you're having trouble connecting by phone and you're on campus, I would encourage you to go in, maybe make an appointment and have a discussion about it. If you still feel like you're being blown off and you haven't been given the answers that you want, there are other resources. Like I said, seek them out. Because I know that there are some student loan experts, certainly in the larger cities here in New York and Boston. I know of a gentleman who's an attorney who does that. You know, you can search it and see if you can get some help and ask for a student discount. You can try to see if there's some law schools that have student loan clinics. Sometimes that's, you know, an option where you can get some additional help. But definitely try to seek it out. Talk to your parents or your adult members, other adult members of your family who may have taken loans and what their resources were. And if you have a brother or a relative who goes to another college and their financial aid office was more helpful, you might be able to get the answers from another financial aid office.
Now, a lot of what you said there reminded me of a question that we recently got from a listener who was asking us about not so much debt consolidation services, but those credit repair services. So you probably know the ones where you hear it on the radio. They say, call us. We'll have you good to go. And every time I hear those commercials, I always end up feeling kind of disgusting afterwards just because it seems so predatory. So do you have any thoughts on those debt repair services? And if someone is looking into those because their situation is so bad, are there any things that they should keep in mind in particular to make sure that they're dealing with somebody that's actually reputable?
Yes, I mean, credibility is really key when it comes to dealing with a lot of these companies. Many of them are fly-by-night companies that advertise very quickly and they swoop in. They may not have been in business very long. Their intentions may not be as clear and as genuine as you would like them to be. So my recommendation is that, one, you should always do some research on it. So if you're talking about credit repair or debt consolidation, they're different, but the warning signs and the red flags are sort of similar. Both require, in some states, licensing. In New York, it does require licensing, and some states, no. So you might want to know what the laws are in your state. Does your state require a licensing? So if you're talking to a company, are they licensed by the here in New York Department of Finance, or in other states, are they actually licensed, not by a volunteer organization like the Better Business Bureau, but a licensing from the government? Do they actually possess that? Did they follow the rules? If they didn't follow the rules, I would use that as my, you know, my get out of jail card. I'm out. You know, don't deal with a company that doesn't follow the rules. If they have and they are legitimate, or they're a law firm and they've been in practice a long time and this is what they do as their main business in terms of, let's say, debt consolidation versus credit repair, because most law firms don't engage in credit repair, you can meet with them and you can have a conversation with them, and they've been doing it a long time and there's no money up front for that type of service, then that's something that you can pursue. You can also Google it. Now, I caution the Googling and the, you know, online reviews, because in cases, there are some online review sites that are just not credible. And not to disparage anyone in particular, but there are some that don't do any background search as to who's making the complaint. There's a more common one where that's done, where you'll see a lot of different reviews, and people can write anything. You can have disgruntled employees. You can have relationship people who, significant others of people who were running those companies, write reviews that the company is a scam. But you want to look at the majority of the reviews. Are the majority of the reviews good? How old are those reviews? We recently saw one in doing some research on other companies. We recently saw one where all their reviews and testimonials were like from 2015. So we were saying, you know, well, where's the credibility if they're only showing us, let's say, these settlement letters from 2015. Are they really still doing this kind of work? The laws have changed over the years in favor of consumers, and there are some states that prohibit those type of activities. So you want to definitely be very careful about who you're dealing with and what you heard on the radio or on TV. Generally, like people like myself who have successful practices, where this is what we do for on a regular basis, you know, we are not necessarily out there on the radio looking for a million clients. We want to be looking for the clients that we can make a difference with and have relationships with and actually resolve, because it's not a fly-by-night operation. It's something that we're grounded and involved with in the community and here. In terms of the credit repair agencies, you know, I've had a lot of experience with them over the years in terms of being introduced to a lot of credit repair agencies. And on the positive side, I'm confident that there are people out there who do make a difference. I have a colleague in Florida who does Fair Credit Reporting Act type of litigation, and she has a very legitimate practice. But as far as general credit repair agencies, I have yet to find one in my experience that is a one that I would recommend a client to go to fix a credit issue. If you have a credit-related issue, you can go directly to the three credit bureaus and dispute them on your own if it's a legitimate line item on your credit report. If it's something that's wrong, you can speak to an attorney who practices in the Fair Credit Reporting Act litigation world. You can go to them, and they will potentially take your case on as a contingency, meaning that you didn't have to put up any money, and they will file a suit or a claim against the trade line, which is who the creditor or the original creditor is on that line on your credit report. So I would be very wary about credit repair. It's why are you going to it? What are you looking to do? And is it really going to make a difference in the long term in terms of credit repair? Debt consolidation, You know, I've seen people come to me, you know, over the years. And again, I've been practicing in debt resolution for more than 20 years, and this is all that I do. And I have definitely seen some really interesting companies come and go over the years. You know, they're mass companies, and they're looking to deal with masses, and they're trying to fit people into a mass settlement process. So you're not getting the personalized attention. You're not getting the look at your individual accounts. Very often, if you're sued, you're on your own. Yes, they have an attorney on staff. They have an attorney that can help you. I've heard all that. But they'll provide you the information to help you do it yourself, file answers. But there's nobody there really making a decision on what's best for you in your situation. So again, I would caution you, if you're looking into one of those two types of services, to consider these red flags. Are they located locally? How long have they been in business? Do they want money up front? Is there, what's going on online in terms of other reviews? Are there one or two reviews? Are there 500 reviews, which is a red flag in and of itself, because you can buy those reviews. Remember, you can buy things like that online. So, you know, 500 reviews is a very large amount, 1,000 reviews, something astronomical. That's a red flag. Now, where are the reviews from? What are they saying? Are there mixtures of good and bad? Remember, as companies and as people who are providing services like myself, you know, I can do the very best job that I can do, but that doesn't make every single person that I deal with happy. And, you know, on a side note, everybody knows, you know, happiness comes from within, and some people are just not happy people, so they're looking to make complaints. I've experienced that, even though I did a good job, even though I did what I said I'm going to do. So when you're looking at those reviews, take them with a grain of salt. Can you relate to any of them? Does it make sense to still go forward with them? Can you meet with that company in person? Who's in charge of that company? Are there attorneys involved? Are there people who have other ethical obligations to a higher level of authority other than just to you? Those are some things to really consider, and I would encourage you, while you're listening to this, to write these things down, keep it on the side, because if you ever you need these type of services or other types of professional services, these are things that you should remember when you're looking into these companies. And the number one piece of best advice I could give you is go with your gut. So many people have said to me, you know what? I just didn't feel right about what they were saying. I just didn't have a good feeling about the conversation. Something was off, and I needed to look further. If you feel something is off and you're not sure about it, then don't go with it.
And I'm going to jump to, I alluded to this a little bit in the beginning because I feel like it's a topic that's not covered, but I feel like it's something that people should start considering because it's a very real reality. And I know people don't want to, but it actually might be the best outlet. And that is, how does someone know? It's my understanding, and you can confirm this, that student loans can't be discharged in bankruptcy. So I'm introducing the B word. So when should people seriously start considering the B word? Is there a financial marker, a mental marker? Is there some other consideration where you're like, well, this is a different discussion than repair or consolidation?
It is a different discussion than a repair or consolidation because bankruptcy, and to go to your point, as a general rule, bankrupting student loans is not an option. The reason why we tell individuals that is because the threshold to get a student loan bankrupt is so great that the chances of it happening are so slim that we just basically say they're non-dischargeable in bankruptcy. I've had people come to me and say, well, you know, I paid for a number of years and I lost my job, so I want to bankrupt them. Well, that is far from the threshold, and that's not where you're going to be able to take advantage of bankruptcy, certainly in the student loan arena. So if most of your debt is in student loan, then bankruptcy is not an option. Small amounts of credit card debt, as a general rule, I tell people, small amounts of credit card debt are not a reason to file bankruptcy. The chip in bankruptcy is really a last resort. It's something that should be not taken lightly because the reality is it has a lot of long-term ramifications. It's on your credit report for 10 years. You must check the box on your insurance, licensing requirements, security clearance, mortgage applications, any type of those type of areas. You have to tell them that you filed bankruptcy, and that will count against you. That will count against how much money you put down on something. That will count against what your interest rates are. It'll count against security clearance, job opportunities, insurance rates. It's just not a good thing. So if you have $10,000 in debt, I'm sorry, Go ahead.
Well, let me ask a clarifying question because I've heard two different markers on this. So you said 10 years for bankruptcy will stay on your credit report. I've also heard that some things fall off after 7 years. Is that accurate? And then what are those?
Okay, that's not a bankruptcy. That's regular. Regular items generally will fall off after 7 years and have less weight. That doesn't mean that it comes off, but it could come off after that amount of time. It may still show up. It just may not be a factor in considering your scoring model.
So is that like if somebody had late payments or if somebody opened a new card then closed it? Well, I think closed cards stay on there regardless, but it sounds like it's for those individual line items where there was a late payment here or something else that was negative, some type of collection was put out there. Those are the things that would stay on there for 7 years, correct?
Well, those are the things that would be impactful during that time. And if you had a performing file, and a mortgage, and you paid off a mortgage, it would stay on there, and then it would probably not be reported after the 7 year time frame, and then it'll come off. So it's a reporting factor in terms of what's on the credit report. But yes, generally those things stay on there. I have had clients come to me where things are on there much longer than 7 years, and the question becomes at that point, is it impactful or not? So it's usually not impactful in terms of the scoring model, but if it's there after 7 years, you're welcome to write, and I encourage you to write to the credit bureau where it's being reported and say, well, it's been 7 years. Can you remove it from as a trade line and attempt to get it off? And that would be definitely in your best interest if you have late payments, repossessions, mortgage foreclosures, things like that. But a bankruptcy, it will show that items were bankrupt for up to at least 10 years on your credit report. And that's 10 years from date of discharge. So that's not necessarily date of filing. So if you're filing a Chapter 13, and that's a 3 to 5 year plan, it shows that you're in bankruptcy, but the date of discharge will stay for 10 years. So that's 15 possible years.
Sorry, you stumped me there. I was doing the math in my head, kind of zoned out.
No worries.
You were talking about if someone had $10,000 in debt, like the type of scenario they might be facing as well when considering bankruptcy.
Right. If you're looking at small amounts of debt, the litmus test that we use generally is, you know, are you able to pay your bills? You're just struggling with this particular piece. Can we re-budget you where we're able to work something out with your creditors and you are still able to pay all of your bills? If you absolutely have no money and you can't put food on the table, then bankruptcy is the option for you. But if it's a budgeting piece and you're making minimum payments, but you're struggling to make the minimum payments, then there is an alternative to bankruptcy that makes sense. And that's where my practice area comes in, and we help individual consumers and business people resolve debts. And what we do is we work through your budget to make sure that you have enough money to pay the bills that are important, have a little money left over, which I know most people laugh at when they're in that situation, but have some money left over and still be able to resolve the credit card debt in an alternative way that makes sense financially for the individual. So we try not to use bankruptcy as a suggestion on a regular basis. We try to help people avoid that. But again, the reality for the individual, and it depends on where you live and what your financial status is, where are you at financially? Are you in a place that you're going to recover? Are you in a place where you're just in a temporary situation, temporary setback, or your credit cards are just overwhelming you and you have too many of them and you know, you're unable to get a personal loan because your debt-to-income ratio is off and you're just spending too much money? We can fix that without having to file bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, you know, we've sent people to bankruptcy when there's really no other option. I'll give you an example of one that we had recently. Client came to us with a judgment, so has no other debt, but has a judgment against her, and she had appeared in the case. So that meant that we didn't have any route to go on in order to fight the judgment. The individual creditor who was coming after this debtor wanted basically blood, and they were unwilling to negotiate and unwilling to release the judgment in any way, shape, or form without the full balance being paid, which was far beyond what this individual's ability to pay was. So that in that case, since we had no way to go legally, we recommended filing bankruptcy. Not something that she wanted to do. She had no other debt, but the judgment was really high, and you know, over $200,000, and she would just never be able to satisfy that and did not want to have her wages garnished until she retired. So bankruptcy, a bankruptcy consult under those circumstances definitely made sense. So again, it's not that it's not an available tool. It is, and it does make sense, but there are alternatives, and the alternatives can give you much more control and allow you to work through a financial problem without having to have the drastic repercussions of bankruptcy that will follow you for quite some time.
And you said a couple of things there I want to follow up on. So is wage garnishment, and is that something that can be pursued by all creditors? I thought that was limited. I got a little nervous there, a little heart palpitation.
Any creditor with a judgment against you can pursue a wage garnishment, assuming you have wages to be garnished.
Hide the wage.
Oh, and some cases in your student loans, for example, with your federal student loans, they don't even need a judgment against you. They can garnish your wages and your Social Security without a judgment. So.
Okay, and that's what I thought. I thought it was limited to student loans. So I learned something today. Take that offline and gather my thoughts. So before it gets to that point, before it escalates there, what would be your tips, do's and don'ts, or best practices for negotiating with creditors?
So, you know, negotiating with creditors is not as easy and black and white as it may seem. You know, creditors are adept at the negotiation process. They know what they can do. They're also, it makes it an easy opponent with a consumer because the consumer is upset, stressed, and emotional about the debt. So it makes it, you're basically a weaker player in the game of negotiation because you're not able to necessarily make the best decision when a creditor says you have to give me the money by Friday or else. And then the consumer says, oh, what's going to happen? I don't know what's going to happen. They said if I didn't give the money, what happens? So the do's and don'ts are do decide if it's something that you feel you're capable of doing. And even though you might have the skill set to do it, do you want to be involved emotionally? And are you sure that you're going to be able to get it done right so that it's really resolved the right way? I had a client see me the other day, sophisticated clients, by no stretch of the imagination are these people not educated and capable of dealing with the debt, and they tried to. What happened was it was a frozen bank account. They released the money. They received no paperwork to prove that that money was released to that creditor, and now that creditor, the new creditor, has the account and has sued them and came out from nowhere. And because it was a judgment, and it was 9 years ago, the judgment is still valid. So under those circumstances, while they negotiated and thought they resolved the account, they did not have all the proper paperwork. And you may not have all the proper paperwork if you don't understand the ins and outs of not only debtor-creditor law, but certainly in a legal situation, whether you have the correct paperwork and proof that if it ever comes up, you can combat it in the future. Because sometimes these debts do pop up again. So the first do is take notes. Take copious notes, who you spoke to, the date you spoke to them, what you discussed, get the person's name. Never give them money without a letter, without some sort of proof. You know, they say, well, I have to have a payment. But you see, that payment can cause lots of issues. It could restart a clock. Your debt may be out of statute and uncollectible, but if you make a payment, you've restarted the clock. So you want to make sure, again, that you're completely aware of what it is that you're doing, because you could set yourself up in a situation where you're obligated now to pay either more than you owed or a debt that you didn't have to pay. So that's something to think about as well. So take the notes, be aware, think about it, do a little bit of research on it. You can always go for a consultation, or if you feel that it's worth it to you, give the debts to somebody else to negotiate who has the experience, who can make sure that you're not going to have issues again in the future with that particular debt, and that it's going to be updated properly on your credit report so that that doesn't impact your financial worth for the next X amount of years. You know, again, in these cases, I find sometimes people are penny wise and pound foolish. Yes, it costs a little money to work with somebody like myself, but the reality is that it's done right and it goes away. If it's not done right in the first place, you can end up in a situation like my other clients where they may end up paying this debt twice because the debt is small enough that for me to file a motion for them on their behalf to try to prove that this debt was already paid would cost more than what the creditor is claiming. So this client could end up paying twice for this debt. So don't be penny wise and pound foolish when it comes to dealing with these things. Make sure that you get the help that you need. Do a little bit of research. Get everything in writing. And never pay anything out ever without having something to prove that, you know, what you're paying. Even if they say, I can't do anything more until you give me your checking account. There's no threat that should make you make a payment that fast. You know, and if they're going to file litigation and they and that file is already slated for litigation, it's on its way and they're not stopping it. So what they say to you, give me a $50 payment and it won't go to litigation. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's not even going to go to litigation. Maybe that's a scare tactic. I mean, you don't really know. In my experience, you know, we deal with creditors. So all we do is deal with creditors all day long. So I know exactly what they're saying to me and when it makes sense and when it's just silly rhetoric to scare a debtor. And they have what's called, it's called a talk-off, and they have almost like a script that they're using to try to get you to admit information, give them information. And I usually tell clients anything you say can and will be used against you when you speak to a creditor. So you definitely want to limit how much information that you do give to them. If you provide them with your name, address, cell phone number, work address, work job, pay subs, dollar amounts, bank accounts, if you answer all those questions, you've just done their job for them. That would normally take them months and all kinds of programs to find out in about 2 seconds. And that's a home run for a creditor to have that information.
Number one, I wish y'all could have seen how scrunched up my face was when you said pay debt twice. And then number two, I think that's a good segue to the book, because you take a non-traditional approach here. So the book, folks, is Learn to Love Your Debt, Life in Debt, A Fresh Approach to Achieving Financial Wellness. So I think no one would be surprised. And actually, we had a little tweet go viral the other day asking about, everyone's talking about these debt payoff stories. That is like the trend right now. So why have you taken a different approach with being a reasonable and carry debt? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, The reason why I said it the way I did as far as my book goes is because life and debt, they just go together. You cannot live in this life without some sort of debt. It's reality, and it is what it is. And a lot of people say to me, but I don't have any debt. But you do, because you have to pay taxes. You may own a home. You have a car. Those are payments, and they're considered debt, and you're considered a debtor. You might make those payments regularly and not have a problem paying your debt, and that's great that you've been able to budget and live within your means and not carry debt on a regular basis that becomes burdensome, and that's wonderful if you can get to that place. But I like to look at it like, since we all have to deal with it and we all have debt, let's look at it in a positive way. Let's look at it like it was an opportunity that was given to us to benefit our life. So we have a car that helps us go to work and take care of our kids, or we have a home that has a roof over our head, and somebody thought enough of us to give us a loan. So when you have that, it's all positive, and it all works until it doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, the question is, why is it not working? Why am I having difficulty paying these debts and bills? When I took them on, I didn't think I was going to have this problem. So in the book, it really helps you understand on a very basic level, debt, payments, budgeting, your different types of loans, good debt versus bad debt, because all debt can be good, all debt can be bad, and you can have a combination of them both. And the question is how to keep your debt on the good side and not get debt on the bad side.
Let me ask there, because I know some people are going to be interested in that. What is I'm pretty sure people are clear on the bad. What's some of the good debt that you would allow?
Well, good debt can be your car, can be your house, but those debts can become bad debt if you have. I had a client that has $3,500 a month car payment. So that is that. $3,500 a month car payment. So that this was a physician who was earning a substantial amount of money, and then when things changed, did not change the lifestyle. So that's no different if your car payment is $500 and you really should be driving a $200 a month car. So people get caught up in sort of the stereotypical status symbol of a car, a house, and purchases, and that debt can become bad. But it is good debt. Houses, cars, even credit card is good debt. Carrying small balances on your credit card can actually increase your credit score. So, and paying them off, paying off debts can actually lower your credit score. But if you max out your credit cards, that becomes bad debt, because it will lower your credit score and you might not be able to make the minimum payments. But if you're keeping your debt-to-available credit ratio at 20 or 30% and you're making those payments on a regular basis more than the minimum payment, then that's good debt. So again, when we look at the definition of good versus bad debt, we look at each individual item. Student loans are good debt. I'm going to tell you why they're good and bad. So I had my kids, I have three children, all in college. I had my younger kids recently take out the federal loan because I wanted to start paying it back for them while they're in school, even though they're going in as freshmen, because that debt will be good debt for them because it'll show that they're making regular payments and actually boost their credit score at when they're ready to obtain credit on their own. But if I let them take a loan and then they defaulted on it and they were unable to make payments and it went to default and they got sued or they had other issues, that what would have been good student loan debt has now become bad.
I like that. And I guess I want to talk to it probably for the younger millennials out there. Apparently we are senior millennials, but you also talk about living happily with debt, which I think is also a mental exercise. I think there's a lot of pressure out there to pay off debt immediately, stand on the gram, show off the paid off. I don't want to shade rich, so show off the paid off assets.
It's too late, bro. You're
how do you get over the easiest way to put it is now social, but peer pressure.
That's a toughie. And I can tell you that, where my office and my home is located, it's a very high pressure place, a lot of wealthy people, and it's a lot of pressure. And the pressure isn't just where you live, it's social media too, looking at celebrities, what they're driving, wearing, and otherwise. And there's a lot of pressure to own and have and possess and then show off these type of items. I think when you're younger, it's harder and worse, the pressure. When you get older and you reach a certain age, you accept that you are where you are in your life and that these things are not as important, life, love, happiness, peace, and things like that become more important to you. Material items are more important at different ages. The question becomes, are you going to do something and have that? And this is where the maturity factor comes in and impulsivity. If you purchase an item and you can't really afford it, but it is something that you did for showing off, it's not going to be something you're going to love, and you're going to have a hard time enjoying it. But again, I believe strongly that you can have both, where you have debt, you have a car, a house, or otherwise, or vacation, whatever you're doing, and you can live very happily. I agree with you 100% that a lot of it is a mental game. It's how you look at everything. It's perspective. Whether the glass is half full or half empty. To me, the glass is always half full. And I look at everything as an opportunity and positive. So when the bills come, I don't get upset about the bills coming. I get excited. I like writing the check because I like knowing that I can pay the bill, that here I sent the bill and I feel like a good person. I borrowed money and I am paying it back. And I'm thankful that I have a good job and a career that pays me and gives me an ability to pay my bills. And I get happy about it. And then when I get in my car, I feel good about it. I don't have to feel, why am I driving this car? And is it too much money? And what am I doing? It takes all the pleasure out of the whole purpose of the item. So it is how you look at it. And I would encourage everybody to try to see your debts and bills in a positive light and say some sort of saying that's positive when you're paying it, not, oh, I don't want to go to the mailbox again because I'm going to have so many bills and I just have so many bills to pay. Focus on them and see where you can bring positive to it and happiness to it and where can you draw from it. We've all been in situations where things have been very difficult. I had student loan debt as a graduate of law school. It was really stressful and uncomfortable, and I didn't like talking about it and dealing with it, and I didn't have the means to pay it, and it was very uncomfortable. But I remember feeling, shameful about it or unhappy about it. There did come a time where I turned around and I said, I just have to accept that this is the money that I owe. This is the payment that I have to make. I can't have other things because I have to pay this bill first, even though it's not my desired bill. I'd rather have a nicer car than paying my student loan, but okay. And then the day came and I was able to pay it off. And it was like this bright light shined on this situation. And so a lot of it, what happens with debt and what happens with the inability to make your bills is that it wears on you. It stresses you out. You can't sleep. You start to argue with your significant other or spouse. You start to feel guilty and you start to have stomach aches. You have eating issues. It manifests itself in so many different ways that backaches are, if you're a believer in like the Louise Hay heal yourself mindset, you can look at some of your ailments and say, where do they come from? Sometimes backaches really come from financial adversities. And the question is, if you can turn that around mentally and start to look at things in a more positive way, then, you know, you can turn around your situation. I see so, and that's one of the reasons why I love my job so much, because I see so many people come to me in such downtrodden mental states. And even though I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a physician, I can fix that, and I can provide the light and then the shining of the resolution process and get them to a place where, you know, things can be better, and I can help you make them better, and you can think of it in a better way if you start to really focus on being positive about it. I know it's hard. It's definitely not an easy thing. You can say it, you know, just be happy about your debt. But the reality is that it does take some time to start to really get yourself into the mindset that the bill that comes in the mail is not a bad thing. You might have grown up in a home where your parents struggled or bills and money was really negative, and that's just carrying its weight on you. And sometimes if you take a really good look at where it's coming from, you might realize that it's not coming from you. It may be coming from external sources. Either you're feeling guilty or it's old habits. But something to think about, you know, when it comes to the debt, you know, people come and say, oh, my student loans. You know what? Student loan got you all those experiences. You went to college. You had a great time. You graduated. You got a job. So, yeah, that student loan bill stinks, and there's no doubt it's awful. But you know what? You got a lot of benefit from it at the time. So let's be positive and say, you know, all right, I have this bill, but I'm thankful I have the opportunity to pay this because, you know, maybe I wouldn't be in this situation. So just my two cents and opinion on, and I wrote that into the book, you know, the positive piece of things and trying to be as positive as you can. Listen, we all know that budgeting is like a dirty word. I mean, nobody wants to really do it. Do you really want to sit down and budget? I mean, nobody really wants to do that. I've very rarely ever heard somebody say, you know what, I really look forward to those nights. It's like a party night in my house when we get to sit down and discuss budgeting. So, but, you know, you can make it a little bit more positive and say, okay, you know, here it is, and it's part of life, and I'm just going to shine some positive energy onto it so that, you know, it brings positive back to me.
I'm personally feeling motivated to throw my party, so I hope the listeners are as well. I know they can get more from you. Where can they find you, either on the website or social media or anything else that you'd like to plug?
You can find me everywhere. So Leslie Tane, T as in Tom, A-Y-N-E. I am on Twitter. I am on Facebook. My firm is Tane Law, TaneLaw.com. And my book is LifeAndDebtBook.com. But certainly I'm on all forms of social media. So you can find me anywhere.
All right, folks, hit that follow and hit that buy. And apparently handing the baton over to Rich for a final comment.
Now, so I was just going to say, I was actually blown away about what you said about the Business Better Bureau being a voluntary organization, because that's always been one of the places that I've looked. And it's been hot or miss when I've been evaluating various services out there. So I definitely think that my brain temporarily exploded. And that'll probably be one of the highlights from the show for a lot of people.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad you brought that up. The Better Business Bureau is a great organization. They do provide certain services that make sense, but we pay to be a part of the Better Business Bureau, and they're just a reporting agency. They don't really resolve anything. So if there's a conflict between us and a consumer, yes, we can respond, and it'll show that we responded. Obviously, if we had a lot of complaints, it would show that we had a negative rating. But it's not a regulatory agency. They don't have any way to do anything other than not let you be a member of their organization. So, for example, if you're an attorney, you're looking at a law firm, you know, their regulatory agency is the, like in New York, the appellate division, as far as the they go, or the bar associations, the grievance committees. Those are organizations that actually regulate and can discipline attorneys for bad practices. And that's the same, you know, there are organizations that can do that in different trade groups as well. So something to really think about. And that's why I like the idea of working with attorneys where there are in practice areas like debt help, where if there's really a problem, they have to answer. I mean, I could lose my law license if I defrauded a consumer in any way. But if you're working with some company, where is it that what can happen? Yes, the attorney general can shut them down, but then they can come back under a different name. Or if under the Better Business Bureau, they have a lot of bad reports. All right, so they just open a company in another name, and now their history is undefinable to you. So, yeah, I'm so glad that you pointed that out.
Cool, cool. Well, Leslie, it's been great having you on the podcast. We're sure the audience will find this very insightful. And, yeah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Great topics, and I hope that your audience benefits a lot from what I have to say.
We're going to try our best to make sure it happens.
So I know y'all are ready to take on the system now, and as I say, put the industry on its ear with that financial education brought to you by Leslie Tain, Esquire. What'd you think, sir?
I learned a lot. I feel like I have that experience with every guest that we have on the podcast, so per usual, hope you all got a lot out of that. And if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. If you don't know how, you can visit paychecksandbalances.com/review. And this week's review comes from Shanna or Shayna Tyler. Headline, practical, hysterical, and informational. 5 stars. These two are absolutely amazing to listen to. They break down 401ks, bring in their money stories, offer amazing resources, and make me laugh while doing it. I listen to many money podcasts, and this is the only one that makes me literally create my balance sheet and seriously begin my savings while listening to Making Money in My 20s. So Shanna / Shayna Tyler, appreciate that 5-star review. And yeah, if you want to have yours potentially read on the show, be sure to drop by Apple Podcasts, leave us those 5 stars, and say a few words about the show so that anyone who discovers us knows why you're listening to PNB.
We'll also look for you out there in the social media streets under # PayBal. That's # PAYBAL, or # for the older generation, PAYBAL. We'll be looking for all of you. And if you'd like to find us on social, we're on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. You may follow our individual accounts at TheMarcusGarrett with 1 T on Twitter because I ran out of characters, 2 T's everywhere else on earth. Rich is available at IAmRichJones.
I am.
And don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more.
Indeed. And so until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.